Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I am so proud that we decided months ago to bring you the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. We've been doing it now for, what, 5 or 6 months? We will be doing it every day until the election. He wrote a powerful piece in the Washington Post. I just shared with you the sort of the intro to what he said before you actually hear him on my radio show. But I want his voice. I want his level of patriotism. I want it to be ringing in your ears when you exercise the franchise in any way, shape, or form in November of 2019. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Well, the reason why I said how you will exercise the franchise in any way, shape, or form is that it sort of lays a foundation for my first guest. We love Mark Joseph Stern. He writes for Slate.com. I saw his piece in Slate and I went, okay, I got to call him. We've all been talking about this election. We've all been talking about mail-in voting and absentee balloting and will Trump leave and will they steal the election? And you kind of put together this just horror story that I want you to sort of share with my audience because unfortunately it is too real. It is too real. And if we're not prepared to understand it, then we will basically succumb to it. And I think by giving us this information, it does two things. One, it shares what the potential is, but it also reminds us that we need to be patient because we are not going to have instant gratification, which is what Trump is going to assume we are going to want. And therefore, if we assume instant gratification, he gets to steal it even simpler. So welcome to the program, How Trump Could Steal the Election, One Increasingly Likely Scenario Where Everything Goes Wrong. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me on. Always a pleasure.
So you can start from the beginning. We know lots of these pieces, but what you did with this was you gave us the quilt.
Right. That was the goal, to kind of help people piece together these little disparate bits of information that seem to be coming out. Oh, Trump is meddling with USPS, with the Postal Service. Trump is telling people not to use absentee ballots, and so on. If you put all of these facts together, you get a pretty horrifying picture. And this is the outline of it. Basically, there's going to be this year a stark disparity in terms of partisanship with early voting versus election day voting. So Trump, we know, has been bashing early voting and mail-in voting. He's been saying, don't vote by mail. Voting by mail is fraudulent. It's illegitimate, right? That has gotten Republicans to say, we're never going to vote by mail again. We're going to vote at the polls. And it's gotten Democrats to say, well, if Trump hates it so much, it must be good. Now, voting by mail is very good, especially in a time of a pandemic, because you don't want to go to the polls and catch COVID-19. They are very much super spreader events waiting to happen, hundreds of people all in the same indoor space. So what a healthy democracy would be telling everyone right now to do is to mail in your ballots. But instead, Democrats are mailing in their ballots, Republicans are going to go to the polls on Election Day. What does that mean? It means that on the night of Election Day, on November 3rd, probably sometime around 10 or 11 p.m., there is a real chance that, say, the three swing states that put Trump over the top in 2016, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, are all showing a lead for Donald Trump. Maybe even a big lead. Maybe even tens of thousands more votes for Donald Trump. And they will only have counted the votes that had come in on election day at that point. What happens then? What if Donald Trump declares victory and says, well, we've counted all the legitimate votes. Anything that comes in after this point is fraudulent. So I am declaring victory and saying that I have won the election on the basis of the count so far. Well, I hate to tell you this, but all three of those states have legislatures that are controlled by Republicans. And for a very long time, since Bush v. Gore in 2000, the Republican Party has had this break glass in case of emergency plan, where if there's some kind of contested election result and Republicans control a state legislature, they're going to have the state legislature simply declare through resolution that, say here, Trump is the winner and he's going to get all of the electoral votes. And the horrifying thing is that may be constitutional, because even though we all vote for president by popular vote in our states, the Constitution expressly permits state legislatures to appoint the electors. And so if all of this goes wrong, if there is a small Trump lead on election day, they haven't counted the mail-in ballots yet, Trump declares victory and the state legislatures back him up, there is a real chance that Trump becomes president for a second term, even if all of those mail-in ballots give Biden a commanding lead once the count is fully finished.
Okay, so you love the Supreme Court. You follow the Supreme Court. So bring my Supremes into this conversation. What have they said in the past? Could you, I mean, is there a way of like almost like anticipatory relief? Could you go in ahead of time saying, is this kosher? Can we do this? I'm just kind of curious. Tell me about the Supreme Court and what you were just describing. Have they weighed in at any point in time to say something where your scenario could in fact not be legal?
So the court hasn't weighed in expressly on this point. Probably the closest case would be Bush v. Gore. And yeah. I think it's important to remember that in Bush v. Gore, there were three justices, Rehnquist, Scalia, and Thomas, who said in a separate opinion, why are we even dealing with all of this recount mess? If the state legislature says that George W. Bush has won, then George W. Bush has won. So we have three justices already who have lined up behind that.
Right.
And we also have a recent decision about the Electoral College in which the court unanimously said that states have very, very broad power over electors. We don't have any case on point here. So this is a kind of a black box for us. But let's remember who the five Supremes are who command a majority on this court. Chief Justice John Roberts is the most moderate of the conservative justices. Chief Justice John Roberts does not believe in a constitutional right to vote. He has not shown any indication that he believes in voting rights. He has never once sided with voting rights plaintiffs on the merits. And in fact, over the last few months, he continually intervenes in these cases where lower courts have said, okay, we'll let you vote absentee because of COVID, or we'll relax the standards because of COVID. Chief Justice John Roberts has jumped in every time and said, no, you can't do that. The rules are staying. And so I think there is a chance that if this happens, John Roberts could say, you know what? Tough. But that's how the cookie crumbles here. State legislatures get this power, and the other four conservatives line up behind him.
So you mentioned that the legislature could do this, but couldn't you appeal before they actually made that decision to the state Supreme Court? What are the state Supreme Courts? Remember, this is a state issue. You're going to the state legislature, so I don't have to go down to Washington. I can just go down to the Supreme Court in Michigan or Pennsylvania or whatever. What about their authority? And tell me a little bit about the blending of those courts and how they might respond.
Yeah. So talking about Bush v. Gore again, the reason why those three conservatives said the legislature had the power to declare Bush the winner is because they basically said the Florida Supreme Court is usurping that authority from the legislature. So the Florida Supreme Court should not be, say, demanding a recount or assessing the standards by which ballots are counted and thrown out. You know, the Florida Supreme Court should butt out, because this is the job of the legislature, not judges. And again, I don't know if five justices on the current court believe that, but that's what three of them believed in the year 2000, and that wasn't so long ago. So I think that doesn't solve the problem here, the underlying problem. If there is really a contested outcome, this is undoubtedly going to land on the U.S. Supreme Court's doorstep. And so even if a state Supreme Court tries to come in, or a state governor, for instance, Governor Evers in Wisconsin, Governor Wolf in Pennsylvania, comes in and tries to counter what the legislature is doing, there is still a chance that the U.S. Supreme Court could say, sorry, the Constitution doesn't talk about state courts or governors. It only talks about state legislatures.
Okay, so you mentioned these three states. So I also need to sort of dissect it some more. Are these states allowed to start opening up the absentee or vote by mail ballots before election day and start collecting the data before election day? So that you're talking about as if somehow they can only do it on the election day, which means we'll have a week later. But some of these states, I know, I think can open ahead of time, and therefore they're already prepared on election day. They already know sort of that absentee vote, and what they're just doing is adding on the walk-in voting on election day. I don't know if that's a breakdown, but that's a possibility that could sort of stop you at this like crazy story, because it frightens me to death. But I'm just wondering, because different states, again, this is like a 50 state buckshot. Every state does it slightly differently, and that's what makes it so frightening when you're looking for a national solution.
So in Pennsylvania, there is actually a state law that expressly forbids any election officials from opening absentee ballots before election day. So not only are they not allowed to count them, they can't even open them. They can't sort them. They can't do anything to them. They've got to sit in a corner in the back office until it comes time for the election officials to start counting them on election day. A similar situation in Michigan. I believe Wisconsin actually can start opening ballots before election day. So Wisconsin may have more relaxed rules here. But you know, the Democratic governors and executive branches in Michigan and Pennsylvania have pleaded for some relaxation of the rules here. And Republicans have just said no, because Republicans know what game they're playing. They understand what's going on here.
And they have
special poll workers who they hire, so you're not taking away from the folks that are overwhelmed by people actually there at the polls, and just have special people who are in a separate room, and they open all the absentee ballots at 7 a.m. or whenever the polls open on election day, and count them all, sort them all, count them all, whatever they have to do, and get it done. They don't really have to do it in this. The only reason that, and I poll watch all the time, the reason why the moderator always says they can't really deal with the absentee ballots until the day is over is because their people are out straight dealing with in-house voters, people who are present at the polls. But they could hire 3, 10, 50, they could hire Mark.
They need money.
Well, and I will say, if I'm trying to like boost you up a little bit and, give you some reason for optimism, I think that we have seen a very interesting disparity in how blue counties and cities and red counties and cities have dealt with this election more broadly. So there is a fundamental problem with funding, right? If the legislature controls the funding, then blue cities aren't going to be able to hire as many poll workers as they need, but they can try to scrounge up some money that might be lying around, some money in the budget, and hire more people. And that's what some of these counties, I believe Milwaukee County in Wisconsin, is trying to do. They're trying to make it as easy as possible for people to vote. And they may be in a better situation than red counties and red cities to start tallying votes very quickly on election day and counteract some of this problem where all of the election day vote seems to be going for Trump. And I think that's something that Democrats and Democratic cities and Democratic governors should be encouraging. You know, if you have the resources, just go all out. There's been some talk of hiring teenagers to be poll workers en masse, bringing in hundreds of teens. They aren't going to be in school, right? School's still going to be canceled. But they are allowed to work as poll workers. They're healthier. They're less likely to catch COVID. We need like an army of people to come, often for free, staff these polls and get these ballots counted and get people casting their votes so that there's no room for any of these shenanigans on election day itself.
Okay, so I have a couple of questions. So if you can only begin counting on election day should start at 12:01 a.m.
Yes, that's right. That's absolutely right.
Okay, so I want to remind everyone, you have hours before the actual voting opens. You still have those wee hours of the morning where you could actually really start getting a heads up. And as you point out, but here's the other question. So I am looking at New York, and New York had a primary, and they had a lot of mail-in ballots. One out of every five in, I think it was Brooklyn, was basically thrown out. Okay. Yes. They were thrown out because there was a wrong signature or there was some sort of scratch mark. My concern is that if you really want to screw up the absentee or mail-in ballot, you're going to have people basically challenging and challenging and challenging over and over again because they're allowed to do that. So now, because there's such a complicated situation, a lot of people have never done an absentee ballot. A lot of people, you know, does their signature match? Did they sign the right, you know, on penalty of perjury? Did you really say you were not here or not there? That's the other thing that the Republicans could do to slow it down. It's not that there are going to be hundreds of thousands of people voting. It's going to be, there are going to be lots of people who are going to be challenging. And that, to me, is what makes it so frightening.
That is very frightening. And speaking of signature mismatch, this is a huge problem. It has been in many states, including New Hampshire, where basically we have just adopted this idea that untrained poll workers can become handwriting analysis experts. And any forensic document examiner will tell you, because they have testified about this in trials around the country, including New Hampshire, that you need at least 10 samples of a signature in order to even begin to identify the regular variations and verify whether a certain signature in front of you is within the range of how the signature usually looks. Poll workers, election officials have two samples, one on the ballot or on the ballot envelope and the one on file, usually from voter registration. And they often have zero training, zero standards, no guidelines. They are flying by the seat of their pants. That's right. And many states make it very difficult, if not impossible, to cure your ballot if you are targeted for signature mismatch. I am really worried about that as well. And I don't have an easy solution for you on this one.
Okay. So before I let you go, you mentioned the USPS and we haven't actually gotten there either. And, you know, we've been doing stories about the Postal Service even before they hired the new Postmaster General, who's really trying to slow down the process. But this has been a USPS has been challenged for a number of years. So we know that they're already sort of on support, life support, but now it's getting much, much worse. So listen to this. So in my state of New Hampshire, and this is just, I said, well, what about drop boxes? We won't even worry about the USPS. Let's just do drop boxes. We know they do it in other states that do mail-in voting. Why don't we do a drop box? Guess what we just heard? What? We just heard in New Hampshire that that drop box has to be physically manned the entire time. I mean, what the hell is that about?
And that thinking, is not normal, by the way.
I'm telling you, it's a great story. We don't know what the hell we're doing. So I was so excited to hear, oh, yes, we're going to put up a Dropbox. But now, and the rationale is, this is what they've been told, is that, well, that's because we're afraid they're going to stuff the Dropbox. I'm going, you could stuff the postbox. What's the difference? But look what they're doing. They're making stuff up as they go along. And because there is no rule of thumb, there is no standard, everyone is trying to say, how do I even challenge it based on what? Because we've never done this before.
Right, right. I was just reading about other states' Dropbox laws. Unfortunately, swing states generally do not have these Dropboxes, and Republicans don't seem eager to implement them. But in other states, of course, they do not have to have a person standing by them. They can be surveilled. You can just plop a camera right above it, right? Frankly, there's never been any fraud or tampering problems with these Dropboxes. They are very secure. But the goal of a Dropbox is to make it easier for people to vote. And the number one goal for Republicans right now is to make it harder for people to vote. Right. And so I just don't see that becoming a solution that Republican legislators are willing to adopt, because it solves the USPS issue. It takes the power from Trump's hands to slow down the mail, and he doesn't want that.
Exactly. So last but not least, we're not out of the first wave. We're going to be on a wave on stereo.
Right.
By the fall, it's going to be not only the second wave, it's going to be the flu.
Right.
It's going to be indoors. It's going to be inclement weather. It's going to be cold. It's going to be bad, you know, air circulation. I think Republicans are beginning to sort of get the idea that they don't want to be around people. They're beginning to understand that they want to wear masks too. They know that even if they don't die, hallelujah, they may have lung damage, heart damage, nervous. I think that what Donald Trump is assuming by, you know, dumping on mail-in voting and absentee balloting is that he's going to actually lose twice. Because what's going to happen is on the day of the election, they're going to decide, do I really want to risk my life, risk my lungs, risk my heart and vote? And you know how I know I'm right? Because let's go to Oklahoma. How many people showed up in Tulsa? Let's go to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, when they thought they were going to have a rally. And how many people didn't show up, which is really why he canceled it. It had nothing to do with the weather. So we are beginning to see, why did they decide to cancel the RNC convention, you know, live in Florida? The one in Texas was completely, you know, canceled except for online. So I think that they're calling it wrong, Mark. And I want you to write a second piece. And your second piece is, all those Republicans decide, okay, I'll go in on election day. And then guess what? We are at a super, super, super high number. And all those Republicans are going, I am not risking my life to vote in one location, to wait online for 6 hours in the middle of frigid weather. And when I go into a place where it's going to be so dense, I'm going to die. So I'm just saying that I think he's calling it wrong, especially because we're talking November.
Yeah, and he's thinking about August, right? He's thinking about summer when there's a relative plateau nationwide in cases, although not in Sunbelt states, right? But I agree that there is a really strong chance that this could sort of boomerang against Trump. I think it's still a little too soon to tell. And I just think that Democrats need to prepare for all of the worst case scenarios and then be very happy if they don't come to pass. Trump is trying to create a worst case scenario, right? And Democrats need to do everything they can to counteract it right now, like passing more funding for USPS. But I would love to think that come November 3rd, if cases are spiking, which they probably will be, that a lot of Republicans realize that Trump pulled one over on them inadvertently, unbeknownst to him and to them, because suddenly they didn't cast a mail-in ballot like all of their Democratic neighbors, and they don't want to go get COVID from the local polls.
And not only that, but what you remind them is, what did they do in Milwaukee? They went down to, what is it, one or two election sites. What you're seeing is it keeps shrinking the number of people. We know that fewer and fewer people are willing to volunteer or participate in going to on-site voting. So what they have done is they are now asking their people to do a replication of what happened in Milwaukee. All right? That's really what they're asking them to do. And their people, by that point in time, are going to have a come to Jesus moment, because they're suddenly going to realize that as much as they want to follow their leader off a cliff, they want to make sure that they're still alive to at least, you know, look back at what happened, or that they're not sick. And I think maybe I'm glad he's doing this, because I think what he doesn't understand is that he's inviting people in at a point in time where even his base will begin to have realized by this point in time that they are not willing to take that risk for him. And we're seeing it happen. The numbers are eroding, Mark. You are seeing it happen. You know that. And just looking at the rallies are my template. If you can't get them to come to a rally, then you're not going to get them to go vote.
Right. Well, he got Herman Cain to come to his rally, and that didn't work out so well for him, tragically.
And
so
look at Louis Gohmert. Look at Louis Gohmert.
People are looking at these cases and putting the pieces together, hopefully.
Absolutely.
But I just have to say that as much as I love you two and respect your minds, it is actually plausible and possible that the first week of November has good weather and no COVID. Or not no COVID, but that it isn't, everybody is saying, well, it's going to spike even worse on election day. Well, we don't know that. Maybe there's a lull for a week and then it'll spike, you know, in the middle of November. But you don't know.
I'll talk to the scientists.
Well, you know, Ken, I think that's a good point. Even if that's the case, though, there's all kinds of studies that show that if you don't vote ahead of time, if you don't vote by mail, you are more likely to just not do it on election day for one of about a million reasons.
Right.
Your dog gets sick. Your sister got in a car crash. You have to deal with a contractor all day.
Your kid has the measles.
And so the reason why Democrats have been so proactive about banking votes for so long is because, as that term indicates, it's like you want to lock them in. You don't want to wait until this one magical day when anything and everything could go wrong. Right. You could hit a deer on the way to the polls. And so even if that happened, I think it would, there's still a possibility that Arnie's vision could come to pass, where essentially Democrats have banked a lot of these votes. It's a nice day and there's no COVID, but a large number of Republicans, for whatever reason, just can't make it to the polls. That happened to Democrats for a really long time. This is one of the reasons why Democrats became so fixated on getting their voters to bank their votes, because Election Day would come around and they would realize, hey, we've got other stuff to do. Election Day is not a national holiday. It's not a holiday in most states either. They've got work and they just can't take the time to go exercise their franchise.
So I just want to, just your last line in your last line in your article at Slate.com, but now he may have to win. This is talking about Biden. By now, Biden may have to win in a landslide to wrestle the presidency from Trump. The problem with the landslide, if the landslide is an absentee ballots and you can't count them till Election Day, the landslide we may never even know about because it won't happen till after the fact. Right. And that's what scares me. He could have a landslide, but Donald Trump could still steal it.
Yes. Donald Trump could always steal it. Always keep that at the back of your mind.
I want to apologize, everyone. We have a hurricane coming, and you're hearing things coming through my window. So that's what's happening.
Great.
Yes, exactly.
Mark, can I offer you a possible alternative positive game plan for the Dems? And that is this. It's scary as heck that those three states you mentioned have Republican legislature, and they're going to pick the electors. But what about the states like New Hampshire, which is also somewhat of a battleground? And we have Democratic legislators. Aren't they going to be the ones who tell us all who the electors are and maybe do the opposite of what the Republican legislatures are going to do in those other states?
Well, Dems don't have the same record of playing dirty, right? I don't know if they would engage in that tit for tat, but I do think
they're dirty. Just wait for the mail-in votes to come.
Right, right. Yes, but I think that could happen in New Hampshire. Because there's a Democratic legislature, the mail-in votes come in, and then the legislature says Biden wins. But they don't have any control over what happens in these other states, right?
Exactly,
so
they
don't have any control outside their borders.
Well, thank you so much for this nightmare. I really appreciate it. I'll call you again when I need another nightmare. Mark Joseph Stern writes for Slate.com. We really appreciate his thoughtfulness, I think. Anyway, thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Always a pleasure. All right, future nightmares.
Yeah, you too. All right, everyone, stick around. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. Thank you.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day IWW leader Frank Little was buried in Butte, Montana. Little had been lynched on August 1st by police agents thought to be working for the despised Anaconda Copper Company. He had arrived in town to help organize 14,000 striking copper miners. Devastated by the deaths of 168 miners in the June fire at Granite Mountain and Spectacular Mines, mine workers formed the Metal Mine Workers Union and walked off the job. Frank Little had previously worked as a hard rock miner and organizer for the Western Federation of Miners. He also took part in the free speech campaigns on the West Coast. Little was involved in early drives to industrially organize oil workers and lumberjacks. He voiced his opposition to the First World War and sought to stop workers from enlisting. When Little arrived in Butte in July, he worked to build strike support, picket lines, and spread the strike to other trades across the city. Early on August 1st, six masked men broke into the boarding house where he was staying. He was beaten and taken from his room. His assailants tied him to the bumper of their car and dragged him through the granite streets of Butte to the Milwaukee Bridge, where he was hanged. An ominous note was pinned to his bullet-ridden body with the words that read, "Others take notice, first and last warning." It included the numbers 3, 7, and 77, as well as the initials of other union organizers in the area. As many as 10,000 marched in his funeral procession. Days after his lynching, martial law was declared. Labor radicals were rounded up and charged with espionage. The miners' strike and union were crushed. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Love is but a song we sing, fears we will die. You can make the mountains ring, or make the angels cry. Though the bird is on the wing, and you may not know why. Come on, people now.
Hi, this is part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So I go to this site called Naked Capitalism, and I love it because it's always sending me to sort of random ideas. It's usually very economically focused, but every once in a while they post an idea of a link to a story, and I thought, wow, why did they put this on Naked Capitalism? And the title of the piece was Drinking Alone. I'm like, huh. So I decided I would click it and I would look at it. And then I decided to look at some more written by the author of Drinking Alone. And I went, I think it's time for us to grab Professor Jonathan Malesic. Is that Malesic? Is that correct?
Malesic,
who is the author of this piece. He is, which I find fascinating, you write about ethical and spiritual challenge of living a good life in America today. And you said, my expertise is built up through two decades of research and teaching covering the meaning and value of work, religion, and public life. And in higher education, I'm currently writing a book on occupational burnout. So what you don't know is I was on my way to divinity school. So I was thinking about becoming a minister. So I've always sort of had this sort of interesting spiritual background. And at the same time, I ended up going to law school instead. And then I described myself as a politician in recovery. And I work 24/7 and have for probably my entire life. So the idea of burnout was something that I wanted to at least have an opportunity to sort of dig deep with you. But before we do that, why did you write the piece Drinking Alone? It was so sad. It was so sad. And I read it and I kind of know those people because a lot of them you could have been writing about in Northern New Hampshire. You know, you could have written about in West Virginia. And as I read it, it was a story about no hope. So welcome.
Yeah. Thank you, Arnie. It's great to be here.
So tell me about why you wrote it.
Well, I wrote it to make people feel sad, of course. but, no, I mean, the essay, which was published in Commonweal magazine earlier, well, in the beginning of July, it tells the story of my experience of living for 11 years as a college professor in the former coal mining town of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Wilkes-Barre is about 20 miles south of Scranton, which, you know, everybody knows Scranton, not many people know Wilkes-Barre, but the challenges facing those cities are very similar and life is similar in them. And I tell the story of my quest to belong. You know, I am an outsider. I grew up in the suburbs of Buffalo, New York, and was educated in Washington, D.C. and Charlottesville, Virginia. And then I moved to this small city in Northeast Pennsylvania to get this job as a college professor, which, you know, I had wanted for many years. And as I tried to fit in, well, I found it difficult. I was not from there. And I there was this kind of culture clash between the local culture of the town and the cosmopolitan culture of academia that I had, you know, spent my adult life in up to that point. And that that conflict that I felt between those two cultures played out in my experience in the drinking culture of Wilkes-Barre. As I say in the piece, I drank to belong and I drank because I didn't. I wanted to be a part of the city and a part of its life, and the drinking culture is kind of, well, it's part of, it is a big part of the culture. And we think of drinking cultures as inclusive, but they're just as exclusive as they are inclusive. They can build walls as well as bridges. And I never quite managed to cross those, to cross those bridges, to, you know, to really feel a part of the town.
You've said something in your article. I mean, again, I hear this sort of the sort of the tension between, you know, gown and town.
Right.
But you also said that, but that's not true in places like New York. It's not true in places like Charlottesville. It's not true in places because it's, they're wealthier, they're erudite. There's like, you know, there's the culture there is a culture that's not only built around the expectation of that college campus, but there is opportunity there. There is, you know, there's a place to maybe sort of be an entrepreneur there. I feel like this college is in a place where there's no place to grow. There's no place, again, it was so lacking in hope. And as I'm reading your piece, it kept reminding me about what's happening with the American demographic, that we're not living longer. That you see, especially in places like you were describing, or in rural America, we're seeing a spike in suicides. We're seeing a spike in opioid addiction. We're seeing a spike in the self-medication of alcohol. And that's why, as I was reading your story, the fact that after 11 years, you still couldn't figure out how to thread the needle tells you how long they've been abandoned too. Because if you couldn't find common ground, then their ground wasn't changing at all. It was baked in. And it wasn't baked in a positive way. It was baked in a really negative way.
Right, yeah. The culture of some of these small Appalachian or Rust Belt cities is so heavily affected by the economic decline, yes, of them.
Yes.
And, you know, Wilkes-Barre and Scranton were both coal towns, and the kind of coal that they mined there, anthracite coal, is just not mined. It's not useful anymore. And when that industry collapsed in the 40s and 50s, that hope really evaporated in a lot. You know, as you used the word abandoned, and I think that that's a fair word, that these cities were abandoned by the rest of the country.
And you wonder where Donald Trump comes from, but I don't. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the idea of abandon, like somehow those people didn't need the next job, that somehow we didn't need to make that investment, that somehow we didn't need to plan for them. We plan for banks when they take us to our economic knees in 2008. We don't plan for Scranton. You know, it just ticks me off. And as I'm reading your piece, there's an area of my state around Berlin, New Hampshire. And Berlin is known as the city the trees built. Why? Because it was the paper mills, huge mills. It was such a successful community. It was just unbelievable. And now the only thing that they have to show, we did do something. We did invest in Berlin. You know what we invested in? Two prisons. Mm-hmm. That's what we delivered to Berlin. And they were grateful for two prisons because it was a job with benefits so they could keep their hospitals open. That was how they saw the prison. It wasn't about a lucrative job. It wasn't about a job that would really sort of be significant and add to the sort of profit base because it doesn't even pay taxes. But they knew that at least they could keep their hospitals open. So as I'm reading this, I keep thinking, we need more of these stories to say, how did we forget about them? Because that's really what Drinking Alone was about. It wasn't just you still being alone. It was that they're being abandoned.
Right. Yeah. And I don't think that there is a really good, obvious way forward for places like Wilkes-Barre or, yeah, you mentioned Berlin.
Right.
Or I lived briefly for a year or more in northwestern Massachusetts in which and there's the college town of Williamstown, which is very lovely and prosperous. And right next door is North Adams and Pittsfield, which are very similar to Wilkes-Barre.
Right.
And, you know, these cities, on the one hand, you know, they need somehow to tap into the larger American economy. But as they do so, you know, you wonder how much of their character and their culture is going to translate very well, or seem acceptable to the culture of the larger cities. You know, what would people in Boston, you know, want to get out of Berlin at this point?
Well, you know, it's interesting because now people are fleeing New York and people are fleeing some of the big cities and they're moving to places like rural New Hampshire, in part because they can now do their jobs remotely. They can do their technology remotely. Some of those locations are now going to be interestingly tested because as people are beginning to flee, I mean, there's a lot of people I know that are leaving New York City. You know, what happened with the pandemic, that was it. They were just too exhausted. They just could not emotionally handle it. So it's going to be fascinating to see how that plays out. But I want to get to your other piece as well, because that one's just so depressing. And this is your one that was entitled Imagining a Better Life After Coronavirus. And you really sort of challenge us on the idea that we're defined by work, not by living, but by work. And I decided to do a couple of things. I Googled something and I found a Pew study from 2014. And people were asked the following question: which would you prefer, financial stability or economic mobility? Okay. 92% said financial stability. That was in 2014. Imagine what they're going to say today. Do you want economic mobility or do you want financial stability? I bet you it's like 98% want that. And that means that people are not looking at being on this sort of economic juggernaut, because maybe it doesn't really exist anyway, but they're also realizing that what's life for? And if you have a little more stability, then you can breathe. Then you know you have shelter. Then you know you can take care of your kids. And while economic mobility is seductive, it may not be worth the risk. And then I'm going to tell you one more thing. So in 1997, I was a fellow at Harvard, and I attended a international conference of women from all over the world. And the question was asked of this large group of very successful women: what would you like, more money or more time? So guess what? The American women wanted more money, and the European women wanted more time. And everybody was so upset. And I went, no. Understand why they asked for more time and we needed more money. Because they have universal health care. Because they have basically something close to universal daycare. Because they're given 6 weeks off at the summer to take a vacation. Because they don't have to pay for higher education. The reason why the American women wanted more money was because they needed to pay for that daycare. They needed to pay for that college. They needed to pay for that healthcare. And so unless they had more money, they didn't have that financial stability. And I've never forgotten how everybody was so like mortified that those American women wanted money, and I completely got it. So let's talk about whether we are going to be able to think about a better life, or is that just something privileged that people like you and me get to think about? Or is that something that we can actually sort of create even through policy investments, let alone maybe a lobotomy?
Right, yeah. And the essay that you're talking about was published in April in The New Republic. And for that essay, I interviewed, well, I just threw a question open on Twitter. Like, is anyone enjoying this whole situation of having to work from home, thinking that, you know, no one would say yes? And dozens of people wrote to me and said yes. Now, this was very early on, and I have not followed up with many of these people, and they may say something different now. But early on, there was a small group of, yeah, definitely people, workers who had the privilege of stability. They knew that their bills would be paid. They knew that they would be able to do their work from home. And yes, like you said, they actually did find something positive.
Mm-hmm.
They had time to spend with their kids. They didn't have to commute. They were able to shift their work schedules around. And just that constant nonstop pressure of their ordinary workday was suddenly released. And yeah, it is to some degree, people who have that stability and financial security who can ask these questions about, well, how would I really like my life to be? But I think that rather than their privilege being a reason to dismiss what they're saying, it can be an opportunity for us to ask, well, why can't everybody have that same kind of security?
And I really do think, I mean, there was a study done out in, I don't know, it was Oregon or Washington, when they suddenly decided to sort of, they did their precursor to expanding of Medicaid. They gave people more health insurance. And so working poor people had access to health care where they had never had access to health care. And one of the things that they said was, it wasn't that they were so excited about going to a doctor. They were so excited about not having to worry about paying for the doctor. That's what got them excited, mm-hmm. was that fear, that constant fear of what if I got ill and how will I afford it, was taken away from them and they could breathe again. And that there was a sort of this level of, okay, they could live life a little bit differently. Just taking that away, they could live life a little bit differently. And I thought that was just such an amazing concept. And you're absolutely right. It isn't just something that people of privilege should be able to ask themselves that question. It really should be, how do we create that sort of stability that we all kind of need, you know? And I think in a way the pandemic is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to sort of confront the grotesque inequality in America. It's an opportunity for us to ask, what's an economy for? You know, is it economy only for the 1%? Or is an economy for all of us? Do I resent the fact that someone's getting an extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits? How could I resent that? That's $15 an hour. That's what that extra amount is, you know? And yet I'm wondering if there's something about the American psyche that makes us think that somehow we have to sort of be on our own. Because if you're gonna look at a better life, you have to have a sense of community, because you've got to do it in a joint way. You can't do it in your own way. But when you're on your own, Jack, then you're sort of clawing to success. You're looking at your mountain of money. You're making sure that your home is okay. But when you're looking for a better life, you're asking people to look beyond them. And do you think that we can develop that kind of an ethic? That's something you see in many Scandinavian countries. It's something you see with Fraternité in Canada. But look what we have cultivated here. Is it possible for us to make that adjustment?
Yeah, well, and I think that the statistic you cited earlier about, do people prefer stability or mobility, is actually kind of ties together the problems that we have with our work culture and the social problems and hopelessness in places like Wilkes-Barre or elsewhere. I think about the students that I used to teach when I lived in Wilkes-Barre, and I heard from many of them in response to the article. They said that it spoke to the reasons why they left. So these were people who grew up in the region, went to college in the region, and then sought greater economic mobility elsewhere, you know, New Jersey, Philadelphia, DC, and so on. And some of them maybe would have liked to make a life in Wilkes-Barre. But all of the pressure in our society is to push, you know, educated, talented young people
to leave
bigger cities,
right,
where they can make more money and, you know, supposedly make a bigger impact. But that just leaves their hometowns in this kind of downward spiral. They might be able to, well, we don't have either the economic infrastructure or the sort of moral infrastructure for them to build stable, successful, satisfying lives in their hometowns.
You write something in again, the title of his piece at New Republic, Imagining a Better Life After the Coronavirus. I just want to make sure I read the subtitle. This crisis is revealing the limits of America's religious devotion to work. Let me just read that line again. Religious devotion to work, and showing us a more fulfilling future is possible. In a fascinating way, the pandemic has exposed a lot of this sort of inequality and given us even time to think about things like this. Let's be honest. It's really in a scary way, whether we can't go to work or we choose not to go to work or we're working, but everything has adjusted and we're asking different questions. We're just forced to ask different questions. And frankly, Donald Trump is forcing us to ask different questions. But you know what? I think this is the best time to start asking this. You know why? Because of climate change. Because now the question is, what is growth for? Because we have grown a terrible climate. We have grown, you know, carbon in the air. We have grown, you know, this idea of bigger, better, more, has actually now put us at sort of this tipping point when it comes to our climate. So just as you write in this piece, you know, should we have this religious devotion to work? Maybe in the long run, that religious devotion to work has actually sort of created maybe the end of this sort of stable climate. And if we can sort of unhook ourselves from this, not only do we save our lives, but maybe we save our planet.
Oh, yeah. A book that has, you know, been very influential on my thinking is the sociologist Max Weber's Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. It's published in 1905. And it's all about this work ethic and the origin of the work ethic. And Weber was concerned with the work ethic in Germany and elsewhere more than 100 years ago. He thought that we were driving ourselves to ruin. But at the very end, he says somewhat, I don't know if it's optimistically or pessimistically. He says, well, this way of organizing our lives and our society is going to continue until the last ton of fossil fuel is consumed. And he didn't know anything about climate change, but he sort of assumed that, well, you know, we're burning coal and oil to fuel this industrial society. And we work so hard to sort of keep up with the machines that we have built and on which we have built our prosperity. And Weber said, well, we're just going to have to run out of coal before things change. Yeah. And, you know, that idea has turned out to be true in a strange way, a way that he could have never anticipated.
What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to sort of take your article, look at what the pandemic has given us, which is both a shocking example of, you know, all this wealth that hasn't produced the stability, hasn't given us a right response. I mean, you know, it's just shown how many people are have-nots as opposed to people who have lots. And I think that that's not good. And even in the end, as I was talking to what's called a patriotic millionaire the other day, and I said, what's all the money for if everything around you is rotting out? What's the money for if, you know, your seacoast is consuming your home? What's the money for? In the end, you know, I keep going back. I can't believe that the story of King Midas is all I keep thinking about over and over and over again. But in the end, he loved his daughter, you know, and look what he did to her. So I am just hoping that the idea of this religious devotion to work is something that we can sort of understand. That doesn't mean you don't want to have a good work ethic. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't feel accomplished. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't put in time. But then the question is striving for something more getting you what you really, really need. And I'm not sure it is.
Right. Yeah. And you know, the reason that I left my job in Wilkes-Barre, it wasn't only because I couldn't find drinking buddies or something like that. But I suffered occupational burnout. I really did my best to be the best college professor I could be and to serve my students as well as I could. But over time, I just couldn't do it anymore. I dreaded getting out of bed in the morning. My performance on the job got worse and worse. I was just angry all the time. And that the burnout that I experienced was a big part of why I quit and why I now live in Dallas, Texas.
Well, I'm hoping that I need to let you go, but I'm just hoping that we can find something positive out of this horrific experience. And I'm hoping that because we have conversations like this, because we are, whether we like it or not, we may be isolated in our homes and we're thinking about our past, but we're also thinking about what kind of future we want. And I think in a lot of ways, maybe what kind of future we want is going to make us rethink our relationship with work. It's going to make us rethink our relationship with people, you know, and maybe we're going to have to start to redefine what is happiness. And in the end, I'm hoping that we can do that and do that together. So thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate it. I'm glad I've never had a drink in my life. Keep writing. Keep writing. We'll call back.
Thank you, Arnie. It was a pleasure.
All right. Take care, Jonathan. All right. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be schmoozing tomorrow. Ciao.
Pick yourself up. Take a deep breath, dust yourself off and start all over again. Nothing's impossible, I have found, for when my chin is on the ground, I pick myself up, dust myself off and start all over again. Don't lose your confidence if you slip. Be grateful for a pleasant trip and pick yourself up, dust yourself off and start all over again. Work like a soul inspired till the battle of the day is won. You may be sick and tired, but you'll be a man, my son. Will you remember the famous men who had to fall to rise again? So take a deep breath, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and start all over again.